Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
BYRONSIGCHOLOPEZ.
This Ben Jarofsky Show, Benny J. Bonus Interview, is brought to you in part by SEIU Healthcare, Illinois, Indiana, the Chicago Federation of Labor, and the Chicago Reader. Benny J., take it away.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Thursday, January 21st, 2021. Those voices you heard at the outset, Mark Maxwell doing his special about Michael Madigan, Speaker Madigan, leaving office. Byron Sixto-Lopez, Alderman of the 25th Ward. we teach people how to spell his name as he spoke up on behalf of the teachers. These are some of the issues that we've been talking about all week long. If you can listen to the live show, you'd be enjoying our take on them. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. No. Today, our conversation will be, I'll just read the headline in today's New York Times. Democracy has prevailed. Biden pledges to seek unity. That's the headline in the New York Times the day after. And we may lead off with a little discussion of that before we get to the real deal. So without further ado, I'll ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself. Distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Sergio Mims, longtime favorite guest of Ben Jarofsky, and Dennis as well, and co-founder and the co-programmer of the Black Harvest Film Festival, among many other things I do, by the way.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, I just watched a film this morning that I very much want to get for Black Harvest this year. It's a year-long thing. You got to keep moving all the time.
Can you talk about that movie or that film, or do you want to keep it secret?
I got to keep it secret right now. It's. I've already been in talk with some people, but all I can tell you is that if it works out and we get it, it's going to be a big get.
Wow.
So there you go.
All right. Black Harvest Film Festival, as everybody knows, is a film festival that takes place in the month of August at the Gene Siskel Theater when we're not in the middle of a pandemic. This year is a virtual. Right. And I'm hoping that we will be out of this pandemic. Fingers crossed. For many reasons, I put this in my reader story. One of the things I look forward to when the pandemic passes and is going to see. I love this moment. I talk about it all the time. I know it's all about new movies, Sergio, that you're unveiling for people to see. But I love it when you bring back the oldies, you get the director, you get the star, you get on there after the show, you get all the people who are like in their 40s or their 50s weeping and memories of movies that they just loved back in the 90s and the 80s, whatever. And then you have the interview. So probably pound for pound, my favorite part of the Black Harvest Film Festival.
Yeah, we couldn't do it this year. Fingers crossed, we'll be able to do it again this year. Let me rephrase that. We couldn't do it last year.
Yes.
Hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll be able to do it again this year, or already have a film in mind, which would be an anniversary of a particular important movie. We'll see what happens. Okay, we'll see what happens. But I have one film in mind already for that.
All right, as always, you will not reveal it. Yes, go ahead.
Can't reveal it right now because, right now it's so early. I don't want to make a promise about something and it turns out it never happens. It happens all the time. And by the way, we're talking about the Siskel Film Center. I don't know if you know or you don't know that Barbara Sheris, who was the festival programmer and has been for the last 45 years at the Siskel Film Center, retired last year at the end of the year. And we have a new executive programmer, Rebecca Fons, who is the new person. She has a lot of great ideas. She has a lot of great ideas about where to take the Cisco Film Center and where to take Black Harvest. We've already had a few brief discussions about that, which we plan to talk about more in detail by the end of the month. So, you know, things are looking up. Just keep our fingers crossed and that we'll be back in the theater again in August, as always, as you know.
I got my fingers crossed. I really miss going to movies in movie theaters, real movie theaters, not just seeing the Black Harvest Film Festival, but just going to the movies. And we will be discussing in detail two movies. I've been extolling their virtues on my regular show and promoting Sergio's appearance. One Night in Miami. Sergio has been talking about this movie to me, I think, since December. I finally got to see it. I'm with him 100% on what a great flick it is. And the other one, Sylvie's Love, which I've been taking a lot of heat from some guests who are a little think I'm a little too sentimental for loving it as much as I do. We'll get into to Sylvie's Love as well. But before we do that, I just got to hear your thoughts on what went down yesterday in our country, the inauguration. Donnie Trump is gone. Joe Biden is our president. Kamala Harris is our vice president. It was a spectacle that went all day, and not just the swearing in, the inauguration, but the first press conference and then the inauguration celebration. It was like an all day event. Your general thoughts, Sergio Mims?
Well, like everyone, I watch practically all of the, I was glued in front of my TV yesterday, watched almost all of everything that happened. And I think I speak for a lot of people in that we thought this day would never come. And also the fact that I think everybody, well, let me just say, at least 80 million people, I can't speak for the rest, feel that it's a breath of fresh air. You know, there's some optimism that things will finally happen. Biden and Harris have a huge job in ahead of them due to the total mismanagement of the Trump administration. Somebody said to me yesterday, very accurate, that having Trump as president for the last 4 years is like someone living with a drug addict, which is true, right? Living with a drug addict is insane, and you don't know what they're going to do on any particular day. Every day is some new problem, some new worry that threatens to bring down the whole house. So, just the fact that Biden is normal and that he's boring, I think is a great thing. You know, let Donald Trump stew in his, you know, wherever, what is that place called in Florida? I can't remember now.
Mar-a-Lago.
By the way, I just saw that he finally got a lawyer who's going to represent him for the upcoming impeachment in the Senate. Butch Bowers.
Okay. I don't know Butch Bowers.
Yeah, he's some South Carolina lawyer with connections with the Republican Party. I think at one time he was head of the Republican Party in South Carolina, but his name was Butch Bowers.
Okay. That's maybe he's a real lawyer as opposed to the charlatans that have been surrounding Donald Trump for the last few weeks as he's professed his.
Well, the fact that he's repping Trump means he can't be that good.
Well, unless he's just trying to build, you know, a brand name or get attention for himself. I mean, it's a high profile case. You can't beat the publicity. My word of warning to Butch Bowers, who I've never heard of, much less met. Donald Trump is notorious for stiffing his lawyers. Just putting that out there. So you're either going to work for nothing or get your money up front. That's just
which
my word.
Which reminds me. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. I guess I'm sure you talked about this, that this report came out maybe 2-3 weeks ago that Trump decided not to pay Giuliani anymore. First of all, would he ever get the money in the first place?
I doubt it.
But here's some really strange things about that. They said that Giuliani was getting $20,000 a day.
Yeah, that's what he was asking for.
Well, yeah, that's okay. But here's the other problem.
Yeah.
Giuliani. Yeah. Here's the other problem. Giuliani always used to claim that he was working for free. Now, nobody believes that. Yes. But he was working for free because of his friendship with Trump. The real reason why he was claiming that was because his now third ex-wife, he didn't want her to know that he was making any money so she could claim it, right? Because he had been going through this painful, long, extended divorce with his now third ex-wife. Now it's out in the open. It was getting paid. Guess who's going to be coming after it?
The third ex-wife.
You better believe it.
Oh, my God. What a crow.
Right.
I have this thought I want to share with you before we get to the movies. And we'll get to the movies, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, by the way, bye-bye, Mike Madigan. Bye-bye.
Okay, we did Mike Madigan, yes. Michael Joseph Madigan is left. Chris Welch is now the speaker. We talk about that in the show all the time. But that's not what I want to ask you. I want to ask you this. I just had this conversation with Ken Davis on the live show, so it's in my mind. We both watched the inauguration party last night. It was pure propaganda. I think you'll agree. It was pure propaganda. But because it was propaganda on behalf of the team that won, that I wanted to win, I enjoyed it. I allowed my defenses to fall, Sergio, and I just luxuriated in utter propaganda on behalf of the Democratic Party and its candidates. Yes, I confess and I admit that. I don't know if you felt the same way, but that's how I felt it. All right. They had a whole group of celebrities, very talented people, who sang Anth Clements, John Legend, Tim McGraw, Justin Timberlake. I'm just rattling these off the top of my head. The John Legend song was just unbelievable, by the way, I might add. And it occurred to me, Kenny Davis and I were talking about this, Sergio, that perhaps the greatest contribution that actors, celebrities, singers, playwrights, whatever, the A-list of celebrities this country did over the last 4 years was not lend their name and their reputations to Donald Trump in any way. I can't think of one significant performer, actor, singer, dancer, stage star of any kind, director, anyone. I can't think of one, a significant one, Sergio, who allowed his or her name to be used by Donald Trump. Almost all of them resisted like hell when Donald Trump would use their songs in his commercials. Somehow or other, they got the Village People song. I don't know how that happened. Do you have an explanation for why this the A-list of celebrities were so passionately against Donald Trump?
Because they're smart. Well, who wants to be associated with Donald Trump? I mean, look at the celebrities who actually did hang around Donald Trump. Scott Baio, you know, John Voight, Christy Swanson, for those who don't know who Christy Swanson is, an actress. Maybe her most claimed role was in that Wes Craven horror film, Deadly Friend, where she actually decapitates somebody with a basketball. As a matter of fact, Christy Swanson was in some John Hughes movie, and 2 weeks ago, there was some. I think this is silly, but I don't know. But Donald Trump makes a cameo appearance in Home Alone 2.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. And there's some people claim that scene should be cut, which I think is ridiculous. Just keep him in the picture. It doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, it's even funnier now. Okay. But now Christy Swanson said, well, if you're going to cut him out, then cut him out. Then cut me out of all those John Hughes movies. To which most people said, I don't even remember you know those John Hughes movies. But don't cut out Deadly Friend, because then you're going to lose that scene where she really rips off a woman's head with a basketball. Yeah. So you're going to miss that scene. Yeah, I mean, nobody wanted to be associated with Donald Trump. I mean, let's face it, when his last 2 weeks, when he was down at the dump and everybody left him, who he was left with? My Pillow Guy.
Yeah, the Mike Pillow
That's
Guy.
It. You know, My Pillow Guy was hanging around. That's how low he had sunk.
Right? Yeah, no.
I don't know if you read this, but Trump was furious that the fact that all these celebrities wanted to perform at Biden's, inaugural ball.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, all he got 4 years ago was some group called, Three Doors Down, whoever they are.
That's my point. And I tip my hat to them, because he was smothered. It, you're right. That rejection he felt for 4 years. And so then there's the celebration for Biden as exact contrast to it. Donald Trump's.
Also, by the way, I don't know if you have heard this as happening, but one thing I would like Biden to do is with Pelosi is try to pass some sort of bill to help support artistic ventures in this country during this situation. Movie theaters, concert halls, museums, drama groups, dance groups, something that will still help them tide over until we're finally out of this mess.
Absolutely.
Because I don't want to see movie theaters go away. I don't want to see concert halls go away. I don't want to see dance theaters dance companies or, theater companies, museums. You know, I can't remember what's the last time I was in saw a concert. Last time I was in a museum. I mean, something that was just second nature to me that I didn't even think twice about, but except when you don't have it, and then you realize how important they are in your life. So I hope there's something in plan to do something like that. I know they're doing it in Germany and some other European countries. I hope they consider doing something like that here.
Yeah, me too. Well put. And all right, let's get to the movies. And we'll start with the one movie that you have been singing its praise for months. You somehow or other you saw it way before anybody else saw it.
The perks of being in the media.
Yeah, I guess so. So you saw it one night in Miami. Regina King shows that she's a great director. I finally got to see it Friday. It's hard for me to describe the impact it had on me. But why don't you start off at the top by saying why, in your humble opinion, it's such an important movie?
Well, first of all, this was a film that's a tall order to begin with, because it deals with a true incident which happened in 1964, in early 1964, where four prominent black men, who all four of them were on the cusp of moving beyond where they were and almost greatness. You had Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, Malcolm X, and Jim Brown. And all four of these guys happened to be in Miami when Muhammad Ali had this heavyweight bout against Sonny Liston. And they all got together. Now, what they actually talked about, we don't know. But this movie proposes that let's get these guys together. And what would these guys talk about? And basically, it's about four black men in America during a very pivotal time in American history. Remember, this movie takes place only about 2 months after Kennedy was assassinated. And the civil rights movement was still very much in full swing in the South. I should say in the country. So these four guys who realized that because of who they are and where they're at in their particular point of life, that they have a responsibility, they have a burden on them, but at the same time, it's a movie about four friends, and it's very funny, really funny. Eldridge Hodge, who plays Jim Brown, who is perfect, has a line in the film, which is the funniest line in the movie. And it's a line that when you hear it, you go like, yeah, that's something Jim Brown definitely would say. Mm-hmm. And then you have Malcolm X, who had just left the Nation of Islam. And you know the trouble that caused. And then you have Muhammad Ali, who was just about to announce that he was going to join the Nation of Islam. And that was a huge controversy as well. And then you have Sam Cooke, who was really at the top of his popularity with hit songs, but he was not happy with the business and wanted to make some real moves that would not only change the trajectory of his life, but potentially could really change the recording, the music industry. Mm. I don't need to say it, but two of those men didn't make it past 1965. Mm-hmm. You know, Malcolm X was assassinated the following year, and Sam Cooke died in 1964, later that year.
Yeah, he was killed.
Still really mysterious circumstances. There's been all kinds of theories about exactly what happened. It's still not exactly clear. But
he was in a motel room. They don't really go into this. We should probably hold off on this one. I could talk about the Sam Cooke thing forever, but yeah, go ahead. You're on a roll.
He was in a motel room, but you know, there's even a really great documentary about it, which basically says that he was set up to be murdered. That's really
absolutely. I don't know if he was set up to be murdered. I saw that documentary, and we're now on a tangent here. Sam Cooke, right. The legendary Sam Cooke, the great Sam Cooke, from Chicago, DeSable High School, one of the great singer-songwriters of the 50s and early 60s, huge superstar, and he was shot to death in December of 1964 at a motel in Los Angeles. I think he was set up, Sergio, by the woman and the motel owner. I always believe that it was a robbery attempt, you know, and Sam Cooke was set up. That's my personal belief, but it's just a personal belief about something that went down. How many years ago is that? Almost 50 years ago. So
no, more than that now.
More than that. Good God. Yeah. Wow. Oh my God. Wow. Damn, time has flown. Anyway, but continue. By the way, the great line from Jim Brown, did it have to do with white women?
Well, it has to do with women.
Okay. All right. I thought it was the white woman line.
He talks about why he thought they were all going to get together. Okay.
Oh, right. That great line. Okay. Okay. Right. All right. So, yeah, go ahead.
But it's just funny as well. It's really, I mean, it's so beautifully acted. Two of the actors were totally unknown to me, and two I had seen before. Leslie Odom Jr., who plays Sam Cooke, and Aldis Hodge, who plays Jim Brown. The other two actors I'd never seen before. Eli Gorey, who plays Muhammad Ali, is terrific, and he's Canadian.
Yeah.
And then you have the actor, let me get his name right again. Oh, gosh, what is his name? Kingsley Benadire, who is British. And the ironic thing, you're going to love this, I didn't know this, was that he played Barack Obama in a Showtime series about Comey.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He played both Malcolm X and Barack Obama. Wow.
Okay. Yeah, the light-skinned guys.
And also the other thing, he has a huge burden on him because, of course, everybody's going to be comparing him to Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
And Malcolm X in Spike Lee's movie. But he's also really quite good. And the movie, even though it's based on a stage play by, what's the writer's name again? Kemp Powers. Mm-hmm. Right. Even though it's based on the stage, but it doesn't feel stagey at all. You know, it's like a movie. It's wonderfully cinematic. Regina King, who's the actress, who's been around forever. You know, I remember when she was a teenager on, what's that show called, 227. Mm-hmm. And she's been in a ton of movies. She won the Oscar like 2 years ago for Best Supporting Actress in If Beale Street Could Talk. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know she's been directing episodic television for a few years now. So it's not like this is her first directing gig. It's her first feature film. But she pretty much has had a lot of experience and dealing with actors. It's really, really well done. And it's it's when you think about it, it's when's the last time you saw a movie about four black men who simply get together to talk about their lives, what they're hoping for the future, what they think their responsibilities are because of their position. But at the same time, four guys, four brothers just hanging around, having fun.
Well, you can argue that Defy Bloods crosses into the same territory, but your point's very well taken. Here you have four superstars.
And, yeah, at the time, this was different. I mean, yeah.
Four superstars put in a room, and yet the way they interact, it could be just four quote-unquote ordinary human beings. You know what I'm right. saying? The way they argue, they make up, they fight, they make up, they go after where they know the sore spot is, you know, where they can stick that needle in there, Sergio, and make some good points, make the other guy squirm a little bit. They know how to play. There's that one line with Jim Brown, the character Jim Brown, the great football player, and it says to Malcolm X, "It's always you light skinned guys who are so outspoken." Remember that part where he starts, "What are you guys trying to prove?" And like, Jim Brown doesn't have to prove anything to anybody, Sergio, because he's Jim Brown, you know. Right. And you know, it's just like blows my mind because, like, you view Malcolm X as this—he's on a pedestal, and you can't imagine anybody ever like talking trash to Malcolm X or saying, "Malcolm X, you're wrong." But in this movie, he gets in an argument with Sam Cooke. Jim Brown kind of, like, you know, they have that exchange, and ultimately, well, I don't want to give anything away. Although historically, everybody knows, if you know anything about Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, he doesn't go with Malcolm X. He goes with Elijah Muhammad. So,
yeah.
Were you surprised at how effective Regina King was as a director at the boxing scenes? Those are some great boxing scenes. I love boxing movies. Those are great scenes.
She's been directing for a while on that episodic television, doing a lot of dramas that, you know, and there were couple of shows I can't remember call where that would require her to do some action sequences. So, I mean, like I said, she had some real directing experience under her belt before she took on this project. And this is something she truly believed in, something that she developed for a long time. I remember hearing about she wanted to do this project. So she was very close to material and something that she wanted to do. I am dying to see what she's going to do next.
Yeah.
I'm really dying to see what she's going to tackle next.
There's a great picture of her. I don't know if you've seen it, directing the character who plays Muhammad Ali, although at the time he was Cassius Clay, whatever. It's just a historical fact. And I don't know if you've seen this picture, but Muhammad Ali is in the ring in trunks. So there's the boxing sequence and he's looking down, getting his directions from the director. And there she is with the quintessential baseball hat that all directors have to wear. And she's got the belt with all the equipment on it around her waist. I'm like, oh, man, that's not a, you know, world-class actress. That's a working director.
You know,
in total charge.
I've been trying to figure out when that became the look for directors. Gee, I don't know. When did that become the because I remember, if you look at old pictures of directors back in the like 30s and 40s, even the 50s, they were wearing suits.
Yes.
They wore suits, right? They were like you were going to a corporate job. Yeah. Then over the years, it became more and it became a little looser. And now, right, it's the baseball cap and the thing. And I wish directors go back to wearing suits.
Oh, come on. That's not happening anytime soon.
There's one director who does. Okay.
Who's that?
Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan wears a suit while directing a movie? I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. I've seen pictures of him. He's wearing a suit. He's, you know.
Well, good for him. Anyway, I urge everybody to see One Night in Miami because it works on so many different levels. Did you have before we leave it, Sergio, did one of the characters grab you the most in particular, any of them, or did you share love for them all?
You mean in terms of acting, in terms of the characterization?
The characterization.
I would say Jim Brown. Eldis has his Jim Brown. You know? I would say him, you know? Because, you know, people have this image of Jim. Well, sorry, folks. There are, several, you know, images of Jim Brown. One that Moreau Anderson always likes to get me on about, you know, Jim Brown's tendency to, get into problematic scrapes with women. You know, I don't feel that much. But
it's actually not very funny. Jim Brown has a horrific reputation beating up women. I mean, it's actually Spike Lee dealt with that. I don't know if you ever saw Spike Lee's documentary.
I think I did.
All American Hero or something.
Yeah, I did.
Jim Brown is a problematic character on many fronts. I actually kind of want to do a deep dive in Jim Brown and bring somebody on to talk about it, because he very close to allowed himself. Yeah, we talked about celebrities who allowed themselves to be used by Donald Trump. Jim Brown and Kanye West. Jim Brown was in the White House with Kanye West.
I know.
In one of the most bizarre moments of the Trump administration, and there's many candidates for that honor of the most bizarre moment. You remember that one where Kanye just starts going off on, like, what was it? Jesus and Trump and why he is wearing the MAGA hat. And
I know.
So
Kanye himself has said that, you know, when he goes off his meds, I'm not joking. He has said that, you know, he has mental issues he's dealing with. He has to take medication. And when he goes off his meds, weird things happen.
Yeah.
So I can't explain it. Of course, you know that he and the missus are finally getting a divorce. People want Jesus Christ. You know, finally now, after all this time. Jim Brown, I don't know. Yeah. Guy's in his 80s. What can I say? Maybe he's, you know, losing it. I don't know what happened with Jim Brown. I don't know. Talk about twists and turns.
Yeah. You know? Twist and turns that ended up with Trump at Trump Tower. All right, Sylvie's Love. You were professing your admiration for this movie long before it became fashionable. I love this movie. It's a tearjerker. It's on Netflix, I want to say.
No, Amazon.
Amazon. Thank you for the correction.
So is One Night in Miami. One Night in Miami. They're both on Amazon Prime.
Talk a little bit about Sylvie's Love and why you like it so much.
Well, this is a film. Actually, this is a movie I tried to get for Black Harvest this year. I couldn't get it. Actually, it was shown at Chicago National Film Festival. Well, you win some, you lose some. But it's a movie that premiered last year at the Sundance Film Festival. And when I heard about it and read synopsis, I really tried very hard to get it. Couldn't get it. But finally, when I got a chance to see it, I really liked it. One of those things that, boy, I wish, you know, sometimes you try to get a movie for Black Harvest, you don't get it, and then later when you see it, you go like, I dodged a bullet. But then sometimes you see a film and you go like, oh, I wish we had gotten that one. And this is one of them. The great thing about this movie is what it isn't. It's not fancy. It's not. It doesn't try to rewrite the genre or the game. It's a love story. It's a period love story between two people. And yes, it's predictable. And yes, you can kind of know, you can see where it's going. But it's so well made. And in a way, you haven't seen a film like this in a long time that is almost new again. And I think the set design, this movie was actually shot on film, not digitally. The set design, the costumes, like I said, it's set like between the years 1957 to 1963. About these two people, she's the daughter of a jazz musician. He's an up-and-coming jazz saxophonist. And he had this up-and-down relationship, you know, romance, which ends in a happy ending. But it's really more than that, because the movie also deals with strivers, as they're called. What do I mean by that? Well, the characters in this movie are very much Black middle-class people, but Black middle-class people right at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s. So what is happening is that you're seeing this perspective of people who are striving to to event black people. Okay, let me give you an example. Okay, all right. I was talking to a friend of mine who saw this picture, and she loved it to death, right? Mm-hmm. And she's a little bit older than me, but she loved it to death. And when she saw this picture, she said, "This movie is about my parents." Right. It's about, like, my parents' generation. It's about those people who were growing, who were young, coming of age during this whole period in the late 40s to 1950s to the 60s, where they were striving to be the new way. You know, that's why, for example, there's a little touch in the film where Sylvie's mother say, what she does. She's an etiquette teacher.
She teaches the proper etiquette to the fine children, the sort of the upscale children of Harlem.
Right, right. That was a big deal back then. That was a big deal. Now, if you're a younger black person, you won't get that. But back then, yeah, being an etiquette teacher, that was a big deal, because the idea was, are you ready? Mm-hmm. Are you ready? Are you ready to go into the mainstream? Yeah. Are you ready to go into white society? Because increasingly the country's becoming integrated. So are you ready? Do you know what fork to use? Do you know how to sit? Do you know how to properly enunciate? Because you're going to be going out into these spaces that for centuries were absolutely forbidden or totally inaccessible to you. So you had people who had to teach, you know, are you ready? And to a younger person, they may sound silly. They may sound like, what's the word I'm looking for? What's the phrase they use? Respectability politics? But it was a big deal back then. And he really, Eugene Ash, who's the director, really captures that whole tone well. Now, background about the director is that Eugene Ash is in his mid-50s. This is only his second movie. He was a singer, probably maybe still is one. He actually recorded some albums for Sony Records. But a couple years ago, he decided to switch to filmmaking and got a degree in film. He's made one other picture called Homecoming, which I haven't seen, but this is his second movie. Mm-hmm. But clearly, he is someone who is the child of those people of that generation.
Yeah.
So, you know, he has some knowledge about what they were talking about and what his parents or even his grandparents went through. So I think it's a lovely picture. Tessa Thompson plays Sylvie, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the actor's name, but the actor in real life is the husband of Kerry Washington, mm-hmm. the actress, who was a former football player.
Yeah, he's a big-time producer, too. He produced the movie.
Yeah, that's why. He's going to more acting and producing.
Yeah.
I'm sure with the encouragement of his wife. But I just think it's wonderful. I just think it's lovely. I know some people don't like it. I talked to a friend of mine yesterday who didn't care for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, to each his own. I think for what it is, I think it's lovely.
Look, it is it's a romance. It's what it is. It's a love story, flat out. But the look of the movie, it's absolutely beautiful. And when you tell me that the director, Eugene Ash, this is only his second feature, I could see he's like a Regina King. He's just a natural, because it's just, and this is a movie I really regret not seeing on the big screen. There's some rooftop scenes.
Oh, yeah.
There's great nighttime shots of New York. It really kind of reminded me in some ways of like West Side Story from what I saw way, way back in the day, where young lovers in New York City at this roughly the same time are sneaking out, you know, under the watch of their parents and having their illicit romances. It's also an homage to jazz. If you're into jazz, I can't recommend this movie enough, both for the soundtrack, and it shows how jazz musicians at this point, Sergio, in the early 60s, they were watching rock and roll and pop music just completely take over, and they couldn't get a gig. You know, it's like the best they could do is be the studio musician at Motown, you know, which is, I'm sure, well, a nice gig to have.
He doesn't even get that because he goes to Motown. Yeah. Right. There's a scene where he finds out that it's not exactly a musician job they're offering him.
Yeah, exactly. So I urge everybody to check it out. Even if you don't like romance movies, well, maybe it's not your movie. And I've been taking a lot of heat from some of the people I recommended it to. Ben, it's so sappy. It's so corny. It's like, how can you watch it? I don't know. Maybe it was an antidote to what was going on with the Trump administration. So two thumbs way up for One Night in Miami and Sylvie's Lover. We're going to close with this, Sergio. I told you I had a trick question for you. Sergio Mims has seen pretty much every movie ever made. And if not, he's read about it. The guy knows more about movies than anyone I know. So just before I called you up to talk about today's show, I happened to see this article that popped on my screen. The 50 greatest Westerns of all time. Now, I don't think you and I have ever talked Westerns. It's not one of my favorite genres. I got to tell you that right now.
It's my favorite of all.
It's your absolute favorite. Is that correct? Oh, yeah. I did not. So the three that this gentleman who wrote this article, he went to 50 Westerns. And by the way, I'd seen at least 25 of them. So when I say it's not my favorite genre, I realize I sure have seen a lot of Westerns in my life. Number three, Once Upon a Time in the West. Number two, Unforgiven. And number one, John Ford's The Searchers. Do you agree with that? 3-2-1?
No.
What are your top three?
Searchers is so overrated. Sacrilege is overrated. Unforgiven is a bore. It's a bore.
Yes.
Sorry, folks. And then what's the third one?
Once Upon a Time in the West, Sergio.
It's good, but let me give you my top three. Okay. Number one, I would say it's The Wild Bunch. Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. I think it's brilliant, right? Number two, I would say The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. Sergio Leone is what I think is better than Once Upon a Time in the West and a movie which really changed the Western. Really changed the Western. And then number three, Well, what pick is number three? Number three, I would pick, and I don't know how many people know this picture. I would pick Anthony Mann's The Naked Spur.
I don't know that movie.
Oh, really great. Really great. With James Stewart and Robert Ryan. You know, terrific little, terse little westerns. It's only like 90 minutes long. And a perfect example of what you would call a psychological western.
Well, neither of these two movies I'm about to mention were on the list. I don't know that are my favorites of recent time. Anyway, and I don't even know if they would be considered Westerns, but they follow they have all the attributes of a Western, and they're two Quentin Tarantino movies, Django and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, if that's not a Western, then I don't know what it is, but it's just like that scene at the ranch. By the way, if you really want to hear the deep dive, Sergio, go back and check out we talked for over an hour about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's one of our most popular shows. Anyway, the scene at the ranch, at the Charles Manson Ranch, if that's not a Western, Sergio, I don't know what it is. It's, you know what I mean? Where Brad Pitt is walking through. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they didn't put Django on there. Doesn't that count as a Western?
Well, Django is a Western. The only reason why I didn't quite consider it is because it's I was thinking about, I'm more thinking about pure Westerns.
Yeah.
Django is a movie that mixes so many genres together. Yes, it's a Western, but it's a black exploitation film. It's a revenge movie. It's a lot of other things. Right.
Yeah.
It's a commentary on the Western. It's a commentary on slave movies. It's a commentary in a lot of things. But if you want a movie that is strictly in the traditional definition of Western, that's why I picked those three.
Yeah. All right, very good. A sneak question I threw at Sergio. I knew he would have three. And I knew he would not let me down. Sergio Mint, co-founder of the Black Harvest Film Festival, two thumbs up for Sylvie's Love and One Night in Miami. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We'll talk to you soon, all right?
Okay, bye-bye.
That's the great Sergio Mims. I'm Ben Drosky. Take care, everybody.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader, too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.